It's just a few minutes after 10 o'clock. You're tuned to WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut. That's at 89.5 FM on your educational side of your radio dial. I'm David, your host for most of these Sunday evenings, and this being the first Sunday, the 4th of the July. I can't believe it. You need to look at Gus a little bit, Ken. Just turn around a little bit. There you go. That'll make it easier. Gus is a natural. So we have a lot of things going on tonight. It's the first Sunday of the month, and Ken McDermott Rowe is here with History Counts, and he's got another instructional about propaganda.
Good evening, Dave, and good evening, listeners, and happy Independence Day. And I'd like to welcome Gus Cantavaro, who's been working for 2 years behind the scenes on History Counts,
Hello. Doing
research and creating videos of some of our programs. And it's long overdue that he'd become on the air. And so I apologize to you, Gus, for not having you on the air sooner, and to the listeners. So thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me. It's definitely a pleasure to be here. It's something I've always been interested in doing. Just couldn't wait for you to ask me the opportunity to come in here, actually.
It's great to have you here. And our program tonight is very typical of the programs we've been working on over the past year. It's propaganda. We're trying to expose the mysteries of the black art of propaganda, which is so important in the way our government is able to influence public opinion. And when I was preparing for the show, Dave, I wanted to do the show for a long time, and I couldn't find a decent book on it. You go to the library, there's no good book on propaganda. So what I had to do was look at the seminal works on it and find a professor, in this case, Mark Crispin Miller, who's a very well-published political writer and a teacher at NYU. And he agreed to basically do an overview from soup to nuts of the subject of propaganda.
So hence Propaganda 101.
Propaganda 101 is the name of the show. It's about a half an hour, and I think we can take calls after the show.
Yes. Do you get credit for taking this course?
You get credit. You'll definitely benefit from it. It'll be harder to pull the wool over your eyes after you've heard this course.
Right, and what should people be listening for? Is there anything specific that you really should...
Well, one of the interesting themes is people think that propaganda started in World War II, and its roots are much older, and its roots are in America and in Britain, not in Germany, as many people think.
So they used our... Interesting.
It's much more subtle as well. It's not just the obvious things that people look for in propaganda, which is, you know, war propaganda or public policy. It's also how to sell you things, how to make you desire to change your self-image, to be like somebody else. And that can spread not only from the entertainment industry, but also across the public policy spectrum to make you desire to be like the perfect American image.
That's
Uncle
right.
Sam wants you. You're the great American
that's
to
right.
go out
it's
there
the,
and just pummel
that's right.
Nazis and
that's
you know,
right.
everything
it's,
else.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yes, it's not to persuade you. There's a difference. There's a subtle difference.
And that's a key thing I want listeners to focus on. It's not about persuasion.
Right,
it's
right,
not
right.
about persuasion.
As you might think it is, but it's not. It's much more dangerous than that.
So I hope callers can come in and chime in with their views. We love to present information, but we just as much enjoy hearing your views. So please call in after the show.
All right, so this runs about a half an hour. Ken
That's
and
right.
Gus and I will be back at 10:35. So here we go. History Counts for July 2010.
Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Propaganda may be the most powerful weapon available to the modern state. With effective propaganda, governments can bend whole populations to their will. And the best part is that no one notices it's been used. In today's program, we're going to uncover the mysteries of the art of propaganda as we examine its modern origins and techniques. So please stay tuned to this edition of History Counts, Propaganda 101.
This is Ken McDermott Rowe. Today we're going to discuss the art of government propaganda. To help us understand it, we're very pleased to have as our special guest, Mark Crispin Miller, Professor of Culture and Communications at New York University. Professor Miller is the author of numerous books, including Cruel and Unusual, Bush Cheney's New World Order, and Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election, he wrote the introduction to the recently republished classic Propaganda by Edward Bernays and is featured in the documentary films Stealing America, Vote by Vote, about the 2004 presidential election, and Orwell Rolls in His Grave, about corporate control of media. Professor Miller, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I'd like to start with a quote from MIT professor Noam Chomsky, and I'd like your comments on it. He wrote in Media Control, "Propaganda is to democracy what the bludgeon is to a totalitarian state." What are your thoughts on that?
There's a lot of truth in that. Propaganda is the main means whereby the state, in an ostensible democracy, has its way with the people. This has really been the case for the last 100 years or so, most notably since World War I. You've got to master public opinion in order to do what you want to do, and the way to do that is to use propaganda.
One of the most important propagandists of the last century, Joseph Goebbels, said, in propaganda, truth should be used as frequently as possible.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Joseph Goebbels was, you know, Hitler's minister of propaganda. He's the example that most often comes to mind when we talk about state propaganda at its most sinister and lurid. But he had his counterpart, he has had various counterparts in the West, even though American propaganda hasn't been as spectacular as Nazi propaganda. I think you could easily argue that the American government has relied as extensively on propaganda, especially over the last 10 years or so, as the Nazis did. Goebbels said a lot of quite brilliant things about propaganda. He noticed, for example, that the most effective propaganda is the kind that calls the least attention to itself. When you know you're being approached by a propagandist, when you know you're being addressed by someone with an ulterior motive, you're on your guard. Whereas if the propaganda seems almost as it were part of a natural environment, it's like the very air we breathe, and we don't quite notice it, we don't focus on it, it's all the more effective for that, because our guard is down. You know, now Goebbels would point to various kinds of film, public spectacle, torchlight parades, things like that. But we have, in the commercial sphere, product placement and stealth marketing and all sorts of other covert methods that, in their own way, are just as cynical and just as effective as the stuff the Nazis came up with. Goebbels was right about the use of the truth. Whenever possible, propaganda must be factually accurate.
Now, Hitler said the great masses of the people will more easily fall victims to a big lie than to a small lie. Why is that?
Well, that's a very famous theory of the big lies, based on the assumption that people will be less inclined to doubt or resist an enormous lie precisely because it's hard to believe that anyone would tell a lie that big. And I think that's a perception that's extremely pertinent to the moment we're living in now.
Now, when we talk about propaganda in America, one of the intellectuals we have to talk about is Walter Lippmann, who wrote the book Public Opinion, published in 1922.
Right.
And he coined a term, the manufacture of consent.
Right.
What was Lippmann's thesis?
He had such a dark view of public reason that he believed that it was essential for the survival of democracy that there be a kind of caste of experts who are above politics and who would have the wisdom, to be blunt about it, to keep the people fooled, to direct public opinion in beneficial ways, manufacture consent, in short. This first became quite clear with the successful enterprise of the First World War. I mean, when we talk about propaganda, as we have been doing today, we tend to go immediately to the sort of grotesque and magnetic example of Joseph Goebbels and the Nazis. But the fact is that modern propaganda, whether it's commercial or political, had its roots not in fascist Europe, but in England and America in the 19th century. Modern propaganda and advertising is simply a sphere of propaganda, were both basically Anglo-American creations, the late 19th century. The rise of this new science of propaganda, if we want to call it a science, coincided with the new interest in applied psychology for political effect. And one of the things that Lippmann understood the propagandist must do is to find the ways in which one might move people people at an irrational level. Lippmann understood very, very keenly that the collective mind, the mind of the mob, if you want to call it that, is not a reasoning mind. It's not logical. That people en masse tend to be irrational. Now, I think that Lippmann takes this further than necessary. I think that his distrust of democracy is ultimately quite dangerous. But he makes a very compelling case in public opinion. Let's return to the example of the First World War.
Right.
Here we had a conflict of unprecedented violence that had to be sold to populations that had no particular reason to want to go to war at all. The Americans and the British were really disinclined to get involved in another war. How does one basically sell a conflict like this to people when the interests being served, in fact, are not the interests of the public? You know, it was basically an obscure imperialist rivalry.
So that's when the Creel Commission comes in.
That's right. When we're talking about the United States.
Yes.
Woodrow Wilson appointed George Creel to be the head of the Committee on Public Information, which basically had the job of selling the war to the average American. And the obverse of this, of course, the necessary obverse of all propaganda is censorship. So the committee's job was twofold. It was, first of all, to sanitize the war and make sure that its true horror didn't register at home, and also to come up with a number of very stirring, purely emotional stimuli that would get people on board. What they did was they represented the Germans as Huns. They sort of rehabilitated this old Asiatic threat and very cleverly identified the Germans with the Huns of yesteryear and represented the whole conflict as a battle between barbarism and civilization. The British were the most prolific in coming up with atrocity stories that actually bore no relation to reality whatsoever. The Prussians were indeed quite brutal, but they didn't do any of the things they were accused of doing. They didn't crucify Allied soldiers. They didn't cut the breasts off of nurses and bat them back and forth with their butts of their rifles. They didn't impale babies on bayonets. The particular commission that came up with these stories had on it a number of very famous fiction writers and poets, people like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. I mean, this is the guy, you know, his Sherlock Holmes stories are beloved the world over. This guy really knows how to tell a story. People like him and like H.G. Wells and others were working for the government in a kind of literary capacity to invent these atrocity tales that would make the war almost irresistible.
Did they know the material for the stories weren't true?
See, I think at the very highest levels they had to know.
Do you think that the writers knew, or were they just fed
the material? It's very hard. That's the most interesting question about propaganda across the board, is the extent to which those who engage in it are themselves convinced of it. The fact is that 10 years after the war's conclusion, a very important book came out called Lies in Wartime. It was written by Lord Ponsonby, who was a socialist member of parliament. It was a short but very effective, very meticulous analysis of all the most notorious atrocity tales that had been used throughout the propaganda drive to get people on board. Ponsonby demonstrates in every case that the story was false, was made up. And this is something a lot of people had suspected, but Ponsonby let enough time go by that people were ready to hear the truth, and the book was an enormous bestseller both here and in Britain, and it did a tremendous amount to enlighten, some might say disillusion people, about what the truth really was. The reaction, after it became clear that the governments of Britain and the U.S. had really basically fooled people on a grand scale, the reaction was quite devastating. It was an enormous wave of anger and sort of cynicism. The lesson here is that, and then this is where Goebbels' point about using the truth comes into play, you have to be very careful as a propagandist not to lie so egregiously that the lies can then be exposed. Because once the lies are exposed, once people lose faith in a particular set of authorities, once the people see through a particular regime and that regime loses what we call its credibility, it's finished. There is no way to get it back.
Now, the Creel Commission had a lot of help. It was also known as the Committee on Public Information. Creel organized all sorts of aspects of our media to support him, the films, newspapers, publication division. As you mentioned, famous writers would work for him. The advertising industry had a board supporting him. Why do important people seem to be very willing to volunteer for an enterprise like that?
Well, the whole media system jumped in quite enthusiastically to help out with this. People felt that it was their duty. There was a certain euphoria. I mean, let's face it. I mean, we know in our own time that the prospect of a righteous war really sets people on fire.
Walter Lippmann mentions that. He says, the citizen experiences a pleasurable emotion as he supports the foreign adventure.
Yeah, that's right. We've seen it in our own time. There are few feelings as, I don't know what to say, as overwhelming or as toxic as the feeling of committing oneself to a just national crusade.
And we all seem to enjoy the power, too. We join in it, even though we're not personally at risk.
You have a sense of power. You have a sense of impunity. You have a sense of righteous aggression. You have a sense of utter belonging. I mean, it's a brainless kind of an experience. You're surrendering your own reasoned mob, and it has the sanction of the whole establishment. It's quite something.
Creel also used front groups, like he had organizations called Friends of German Democracy and the League of Oppressed Nations. Why is a propagandist find those types of things useful?
Again, propaganda is that much more compelling when it seems not to be propaganda. If stuff comes directly from the government, it's going to be less impressive than stuff that seems to come from groups of citizens. Using front groups is a way to make the propaganda drive seem to come from everywhere. Everybody's on board.
But you'd also mentioned censorship. And Lippmann said on that subject, without some form of censorship, propaganda is impossible. Is it necessary to have that backstop?
Well, yes. People often mistakenly use the word persuasion as a kind of synonym for propaganda. Propaganda is not persuasion. Persuasion involves argument. Persuasion involves dialogue. You and your adversary sort of hash it out. He or she has his or her counterarguments, and you address them, and you try to bring that person around to your way of thinking. Propaganda wants to obliterate. It wants all other points of view already to have been obliterated.
So it's fundamentally anti-democratic.
It's fundamentally anti-democratic. It's anti-rational. It wants not to persuade you. Rather, it wants to create a universe in which you would never even stop to think that there might be another way of looking at it. And this is exactly how state propaganda works. It does not want to engage in argument. It wants to create an entirely hermetic space where there is nothing but itself making its points over and over again. If you're allowed to hear from the other side, it's always the other side as concocted by the propagandists themselves. But no one can really break into this system. It's closed tight as a drum.
One of the most important propagandists to come out of World War I, perhaps the most important, was Edward Bernays. And in his book Propaganda, originally published in 1928, Bernays wrote, quote, "Those who manipulate the masses constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. And propaganda is the executive arm of the invisible government." Could you talk about that?
Bernays is very, very heavily influenced by Lippmann, but he had far less ambivalence. He had no ambivalence whatsoever about the craft of propaganda, whereas Lippmann was at least mindful of the objections on democratic grounds. Bernays called himself the father of public relations, and indeed, he was probably the foremost practitioner of commercial propaganda out there. This isn't just advertising per se. Bernays was a brilliant man who understood that you don't sell things directly, but rather figure out how to manipulate circumstances so that you create desires without specifically trumpeting the virtues of a particular product. Let me give you an example. He was hired by a piano company to help improve the sales of pianos. This is sometime in the 20s. Well, what he did was he actually made a successful effort to popularize the idea of adding music rooms to private homes. You know, he did this by working with people in architectural magazines and so on. Created a fad for music rooms. Well, once you have created that fad and people are eager to build music rooms, it's only natural that piano companies will benefit. And in particular, the piano company that had hired Bernays because they could then take advantage of that new architectural innovation, standing ready to provide pianos that will fit perfectly in with this new decor.
So he had the patience to come at the problem indirectly and
exactly.
to nurture the demand.
He came at the problem indirectly. And the book Propaganda is very impressive. It is not in any sense a detached analysis of propaganda. It is actually a kind of sales brochure for Bernays' own services.
Although he was basically a commercial person, one of the groups he represented was United Fruit, which got him involved in a 1954 CIA coup in Guatemala against Arbenz.
That's right.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. This is where Bernays becomes extremely interesting. We spoke before about the difficulty of figuring out exactly how conscious the propagandist is of the spuriousness of his claims. Is he a self-conscious manipulator, knowingly telling lies? Or is he someone who, at some level, actually has persuaded himself that what he's saying is true? But if you go back and you look at his autobiography and read his chapter on his involvement with the United Fruit Company in Guatemala, you can see clearly that he was tremendously troubled by the fact that United Fruit and the CIA were simply destroying a democratic government.
His role would be to help place articles in prominent American media suggesting that the democratically elected head of Guatemala was a communist?
Yes. In this instance, he is a study in self-delusion.
And at the end of the operation, of course, Arbenz was undermined and forced out of power.
It set democracy in that country back decades and opened the door to a hideous series of bloody dictatorships. You know, it was a major crime against humanity, but he would never have been able to see it that way.
And of course, now in more recent events, and we see the use of many important propaganda techniques in the Persian Gulf War and in the Iraq War. In the 1980s, for example, Saddam Hussein was a strong ally of the United States and was portrayed very sympathetically in our media. And in 1990, he became worse than Hitler. How did George Bush Sr. do that?
This is a good example of how propaganda works. There were a number of inconvenient facts that stood in the way of marshaling broad mass American support of the first Gulf War. Amnesty International did a harrowing report on human rights abuses in Iraq in the 80s. Basically, this all happened without any media attention. The crucial fact is our government turned a deliberately blind eye to those atrocities. They wanted basically to play Iran and Iraq off against each other. So they were arming Saddam Hussein. They were giving him all those weapons of mass destruction. There was an outfit called the U.S.-Iraq Business Forum that was put together in 1983 or 4, whose whole purpose was to promote profitable opportunities for the likes of Philip Morris and Xerox and Boeing and all the rest of them. It was basically a kind of a corporate effort to further warm relations between the U.S. and Iraq. It had the blessings of Donald Rumsfeld and people like that. All of that had to disappear down the memory hole when it came time to demonize Saddam Hussein for his invasion of Kuwait. The fact is, he was a bloodthirsty maniac. He had been one all along. It ultimately,
even when he was our friend. Yeah.
He was our maniac. In order for the propaganda to work, in 1990, especially leading up to the Gulf War of 1991, it was crucial to sanitize the record.
The media helped by just not talking about it, and then by giving a very big play to events such as that pseudo-congressional hearing with Tom Lantos. Could you talk about that? Because that's
one of the most astonishing things that the propaganda forces did. This is Hill and Knowlton was basically in charge of that whole interview.
They're a public relations firm?
Huge public relations firm that's been around for decades. Probably the biggest one in the world. They were hired by the Kuwaiti government in exile to do, in 1990, what Britain and the U.S. did in 1915, which is to sell a big war to a population that really wasn't interested in it. And the campaign, the atrocity drive against Saddam Hussein, was eerily similar to the drive to demonize Germany after it had invaded Belgium. The rape of Belgium is what they called the earlier event, and the rape of Kuwait is what they called the later event. And the similarities are many, and they are quite striking. What Hill and Knowlton did, among other many other things, was to coach the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States, have her testify in a congressional hearing about the notorious episode in which Iraqi troops took over a hospital in Kuwait City and emptied all these incubators that had newborn or premature babies in them. Her name was supposedly Nayira, and she testified very effectively, you know, tearfully, about having witnessed what these Iraqi troops did. And it was something like, I don't know, 32 incubators. They emptied them out on the floor. It was quite grotesque, quite gruesome. And everybody flipped out. This was exactly the kind of thing that a propagandist dreams of, because it was so hideous and seemed to be so unimpeachable that people were hollering themselves hoarse to use this as a reason for us to go in there and smash the Iraqis as soon as possible. Well, it turned out, according to John MacArthur, the publisher of Harper's Magazine, who wrote a book about the buildup to the war in 1991, that this was not just some little Kuwaiti girl who happened to be working in a hospital. She had not been in a hospital. She wasn't your average Kuwaiti teenager. She was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. She was a member of the family that ran the country. This whole performance was just that. It was a piece of theater. What she said happened never happened. Human rights observers of various kinds, you know, who went back and actually did take a look at what Saddam Hussein did do in Kuwait, could find no evidence that any of these incubators were emptied in this way. But many more people to this day have heard that Saddam Hussein's troops did this than have heard that it didn't happen.
The Iraq War, 2002 build-up, 2003, the administration again used many important propaganda techniques. One I think is most effective is just the slogan, War on Terror.
Oh, yes, and of course the attack on the World Trade Center.
And this idea of constantly associating whoever you don't like with that attack.
War propaganda is inevitably Manichaean in this way. It divides the universe into black and white. Good and evil.
So eventually, a majority of Americans believed that Saddam Hussein participated in the attack on the World Trade Center.
Well, yeah, for a while there, I think some 60-some percent of the American people believed there was a link between Saddam Hussein and the attack on 9/11.
And again, as in World War I, you frame the debate in terms you can't lose. Support the troops. I guess that means if you oppose the policy, then you obviously don't like the troops.
Right.
If
exactly
you oppose
right.
the policy, you're in favor of terrorists.
That's right.
You also mentioned that Orwellian newspeak, you discussed that in the film, was used frequently in the war. Things like, I guess, Operation Iraqi Freedom would be an example.
Yeah. The Bush administration necessarily made us rethink Orwell, because all those tactics, those perverse tactics, calling things by the opposite of what they are, war is peace, freedom is slavery. I mean, we used to think of that kind of thing as purely satiric, a kind of exaggeration of what went on in places like Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia. But now it's obvious that this kind of thing can go on here and now in an ostensibly free country with an ostensibly free press. Now it is routine for programs to be called by the opposite of their proper names.
The Clean Skies Act, for
Clean
example.
Clean Skies Initiative, Healthy Forests Initiative.
Leave no child left behind.
No child left behind.
You can't win these arguments.
No, you can't. If you use their language, you've already succumbed to their agenda. It was obvious they never intended not to invade Iraq. You know, they basically flipped from rationale to rationale with a kind of dizzying speed that, you know, a truly democratic media system would have pointed out. But here, the mainstream, the so-called liberal media, was completely complicit in this.
The performance, the media, and the current war does relate to the issue of a concentration of media ownership, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yes, absolutely.
You quote, I believe it's Joseph Goebbels, in the film Orwell Rolls in His Grave, where he said, "What you want in a media system is ostensible diversity that conceals an actual uniformity."
Yeah, that's a quote of Goebbels's, another chillingly prescient quote. The Nazis' propaganda was not highly dogmatic, explicitly anti-Semitic, party drivel that everybody was force-fed day after day. The daily media diet that people took in under the Nazis was not all that different from ours. There's a lot of fluff, a lot of human interest, a lot of detective magazines, crime stories. Only a small minority of the films that Goebbels produced were outright Nazi propaganda films, because people shied away from that sort of thing.
We have a number of different networks. Why is it when you turn the dial, they're often covering the same story and giving you the same perspective?
The news serves a function absolutely antithetical to the function of propaganda. The two ought to be, ideally speaking, complete opposite. Our news divisions now are simply one small part of a much larger machine, a much larger media cartel. We're talking about five or so parent companies, and all they really want to do is make as much money as possible. They're only thinking about the stock price. Plus, they're in business with each other. They're not mere competitors. They have all kinds of strategic partnerships. They own stock in each other's parent firms. So it's really them and the government against the people. This is exactly the opposite of what the framers had in mind when they wrote the First Amendment.
Is there a self-correcting mechanism in our system that can restore power to the people?
Well, there's not a self-correcting mechanism. What we need is to return to the principles of the First Amendment. The press that the framers had in mind when they drafted the First Amendment bore no relation to the media industry we have today. The idea that, you know, highly capitalized commercial firms would be providing people with news, the likes of General Electric and Disney would be in charge of the media. This would have appalled and mystified the framers. Back in their day, the press was basically any citizen who could afford to set up a printing press and start publishing a newspaper. The blogosphere of today is far closer to the press of the 18th century than the so-called media. So the only way that we're going to rectify the situation and to democratize the press in this country again is through radical media reform. We have got to break down these cartels. We've got to re-regulate the broadcast media. We have a tremendous amount of work to do to reverse the damage that's been done to the press, first by Reagan and then by Clinton. It was they who did the most to corporatize the media and enable this nonstop consolidation. There's no self-correcting mechanism aside from the willingness and commitment of the people to insist on change, because it's only when the government fears its people that it will listen to them.
Thank you very much, Professor Miller.
All right.
You're listening to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been speaking with Mark Crispin Miller, Professor of Culture and Communications at New York University, about the origins and techniques of modern government propaganda. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs, see a schedule of upcoming shows, and sign up for our monthly newsletter and podcasts. Thanks for joining us today. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.
All right, back on the air with Ken McDermott Rowe and Gus, and we're going to take some phone calls, right, Ken?
Right, we'd love to hear from you. We're at 203-336-9756. That's 336-9756, and we'd love to hear from you. It's not just a one-way communication here at WPKN. We like to hear from members of the community.
Right. So what did you think of that? What did you learn from the show?
Well, one of the questions we were talking about, Gus and I were talking about before the program, was how does the audience know that it's being propagandized? Because if it's really good propaganda, you're not supposed to notice.
Right.
What do you think, Gus?
Well, you know, I think, as we were talking about before, anybody has the ability to know that they're being lied to, that they're being given a bill of goods. And I think if you are able to just keep your mind open and know that the people on the television right now and on the radio and in the newspapers and the articles, they have an agenda. They work for somebody who has an agenda. And if they deviate from that line of thinking, most of the time they lose their jobs. And, you know, for a good example of that is Helen Thomas recently got fired, or, you know, she retired, but she was pushed into retirement because she said something untoward to Israel. And the company that she works for, their official stance is not quite so harsh, and so therefore they can't be associated with her.
So she was gone.
Yeah, so she was pushed out, and that happens all the time. And so, for example, what Mark Crispin Miller was talking about with the blogosphere being a representation of the old-time printing presses, you know, which is real journalism, because they're not beholden to anybody for sponsorships or for you know, like, you know, if we couldn't talk about this on Fox right now. We couldn't talk about this on WABC. Because that's their job. Their job is to propagandize you and to toe a party line.
And as Professor Miller said, they're not trying to encourage a conversation.
No.
Well, they're trying to eliminate the conversation.
Right. Yeah.
And that's the most anti-democratic
element. Well, their agenda is to sell crap.
But when you listen to their...
I'm saying that's what the propaganda is.
Yeah, it's so either a product or it's an image or it's a line of thinking. It's support, usually.
Right, right.
Propaganda could also be pretty subtle. And the New York Times actually pointed out the use of propaganda this week in an article on Iraq, as it noted that the description of our military operations in Iraq is no longer called combat operations. It's now called stabilizing operations. And I was interested
that
the New York Times, which is pretty guilty often of pushing the war agenda, was able to see through that.
Well, you can't have a Walmart in a war zone, so you know they got to stabilize it.
They've got to stabilize it.
They need to change the names of those Predator drones to something a lot more friendly. Then
one of the points that Professor Miller made that I thought was very important was that the government should always use propaganda facts that are true, but. If it can't, if it tells a lie, a big lie, an egregious lie, and it's caught, then it will lose all of its credibility. So it can't get it back.
Now, see, that's why I think they're able to insulate, why they choose to insulate themselves with that cloud of using corporate media, because then when the government is lying to you, it's not the government that's telling you.
I see. Similar to the front groups.
They have a government employee who then is their official correspondent for the Pentagon for CNN.
Right.
And then whatever news that correspondent gives you has been given directly from the Pentagon.
But there's a step removed. If there's a mistake, then he can insulate himself.
Yeah, they can say, well, I don't know. This is just what I was given.
But you're not supposed to know any of that.
One good example that we've discussed before is the Osama bin Laden confession video.
Yeah.
Which... I mean, is it? Do you think it's real? I mean, it's been cited by people all the time.
I haven't heard this. So, what is it? What is this?
The confession video was a VHS tape, which was supposedly found in Jalalabad in December of 2001, after we invaded. It was found supposedly by American soldiers in this house in Jalalabad, and on this VHS, it had supposedly had a label. Which said November 9th, 2001. And on this VHS, very conveniently, Osama bin Laden, while he's presumably being pursued by the American Army during the invasion, he takes time out to attend a party, which he describes and admits his involvement in the attack on the World Trade Center. And people have critiqued it. You can go see it on YouTube. Just put in Osama bin Laden confession tape, and you will find copies of this. And you can look at it.
So Osama bin Laden... going to a party.
And he supposedly...
Well, that they do parties. They sit around and they eat...
But the visualization of that changes my whole perspective of him.
Well, it's an informal get-together, and he supposedly says, and according to the translator, yes, it was a great job we did on 9/11, and he mentions the names, incorrect names, as it turns out, of some of the alleged perpetrators of it. And this confession video... is really the only significant piece of evidence that it can be cited by that's been cited by the Bush administration, now Obama's administration, connecting him to 9/11.
Even still, the FBI has him on the most wanted list, but he's not wanted for the crimes of 9/11.
That's right. The FBI, believe it or not, Dave, is not seeking Osama bin Laden in connection with 9/11. And when asked, the spokesman said, because we don't have the evidence linking him to 9/11. And so when you look at this tape, you say, well, isn't this the confession? But people who've studied it, and anyone who looks at it on YouTube can see, the man in the tape does not look like Osama bin Laden.
There's been numerous videos and recordings. Each time those things come out, right, if you always look at the end of the article, it always says, this has not been verified yet. It's always from Intel Center. Intel Center is always the company the group that brings it out. They say that we've received this through the internet message board. Here's a recording, you know, and it's usually the Al Qaeda message board or something.
That's right. And the Intel group is tied to the Defense Department.
Right.
So many people believe that the Osama bin Laden confession tape of December that was found in December 2001 is a fraud. The man in the tape is not Osama bin Laden. He's much healthier. Osama bin Laden was
right. We know that he was getting kidney dialysis right before 9/11 happened. He was in a U.S. Army military base getting the dialysis.
And there are verifiable pictures of Osama bin Laden.
Sick.
And he's gaunt and his beard is gray.
Exactly.
He looks. And on top of it all, an Egyptian paper reported in December that Osama bin Laden died and was buried.
Mm-hmm.
And the source for this...
At Tora Bora, right?
At Tora Bora. And the source for this Egyptian story is a member of the Afghan Taliban who said, I was at the funeral and I saw Osama bin Laden's face before they put him in the ground.
Right. So looking at the FBI's most wanted list, he is number one. And he is wanted in connection with the August 7th, 1998 bombings of the United States embassies in Tanzania, Nairobi, Kenya, and killed over 200 people. Doesn't say anything at all about
the World Trade Center, right? And so, well, now, if this is a lie, if this video is a lie, then one would assume that all, and then energy died in Tora Bora in December.
Well, wait a second. There's a commercial connection here. There's this ad was brought to you by, there's a $25 million reward for leading up the information, for information leading up to his arrest and apprehension. And in addition, $2 million is being offered as a program developed and funded through the Airline Pilots Association.
So I guess that money's pretty safe if he died in Tora Bora in 2001.
Why not just make it a billion?
You could. So now that means, though, that all of the subsequent videotapes are fabrications. So now, if these were...
It really damages the credibility. I mean, right. you're referring to what's known as the fat face bin Laden video.
This is the confession.
Yeah.
Right, where his nose is too big.
Yeah, he's got a very round face. His nose is more bulbous. His eyes are different set. His eyebrows are much more like bushy and round.
He's very healthy looking.
Yeah.
He uses his right hand, the wrong hand.
It's the
right
wrong hand.
The wrong hand. He's wearing rings on his finger and bin Laden.
And that dovetails directly with the recent report. And of course, I'm kicking myself for not printing that one out. But where it's a former CIA agent admitting to faking
that was the Washington Post,
okay,
May 25th, 2010.
They admitted to faking a Saddam video where they wanted to make him appear gay.
That's right.
To damage his credibility.
That's right. He was still around a campfire with some other
young boys, right?
Right, and they were supposedly drinking liquor and making comments, comments.
And they admitted that the people in the video were employees at the CIA who were just dark-skinned, and they also faked an Osama bin Laden video, but then he said, but we didn't release it. Now I'm supposed to believe that they faked these videos, just these two.
That's right.
And they never did any more because they relearned their lesson and they didn't want to go forward with it. But, you know, and that, I think that brings us into one of these articles that I did bring along. This is from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And it's an action alert from March 27th, 2000. So this goes back to the Clinton administration, and this is just to prove that it goes across all administrations, Republican and Democrat, and that there's no change in the tide in the way that things are accomplished. And what this goes on to say, it says, reports in the Dutch newspaper Trouw and France's intelligence newsletter have revealed that several officers from the U.S. Army's 4th Psychological Operations, also known as PSYOPs, group at Fort Bragg, worked in the news division at CNN's Atlanta headquarters last year, starting the final days of the Kosovo War. And the article goes on to just say that they're trying to correct the image that was being portrayed to show that what they were doing was proper, you know, that there were no war crimes being committed, that they needed to, that we needed to be there to get American support for the war. And it goes on to say, a senior U.S. official described OPD, which is the National Security Council's Office of Public Diplomacy, and as a vast psychological warfare operation of the kind the military conducts to influence a population in enemy territory, except that they were doing it here in the United States. And, you know, I think CNN's credibility as a news agency has to be questioned after a report like that.
Absolutely. And of course, all of the times that we're presented with military experts who, it turns out, are actually going over to the Pentagon and getting their talking points, then appearing on the networks and as if they were independent analysts.
That reminds me, you just sparked my memory of, do you remember during, I think it was probably 2006 or 7, there a report came out that showed that a number of Fox News correspondents who were former generals, colonels, captains, they were on the payroll of Fox News, and they were supposedly just independent military experts.
Right.
But they were on the payroll, so that they were also going back and influencing policy and coming and so basically it was just a direct line from the government to report to the people, to give supposed military expertise. Right. But really what they're trying to do is just come on, wear their uniform
right.
and influence your opinion.
That's right.
That's propaganda.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, the control of the national security agencies over our press goes back to the very beginning of the CIA. And there's an excellent book on the history of the CIA, Legacy of Ashes by Tim Werner. And he says that, this is now we're talking the 1950s, Alan Dulles, who was a CIA director in the 50s and early 60s, said he could pick up the phone and edit any breaking story. It was second nature for Dulles to plant stories in the press. The connections
nature.
That they had were so good in the press that cultivated these people. And this continued, we know, through the 70s. Carl Bernstein wrote a very important article on it, the 1977 issue of Rolling Stone. And the Senator Frank Church, who did the famous committee looking into COINTELPRO and the and government's illegal activities against political dissidents, also looked into this connection. And then CIA Director George Bush revealed that hundreds of journalists, this is in the 70s, and their bosses were either paid or volunteer CIA assets.
Volunteer.
You're right. And he refused to give the Senate committee the names of the assets. And that's he protected his sources. But, you know, why do people cooperate? Why do you think people cooperate with the CIA? And if you're working for news media.
They've got the guns.
They've got the guns also. It's got to be good for your career.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, look at Anderson Cooper.
Right.
You know, he went to Yale, and Yale is a well-known CIA recruiting ground. And, as the story goes, again, this is from memory. I didn't print this one up, but... he was very interested in the intelligence agency, and he decided that he would prefer to go into journalism. But I mean, rarely does an asset get away from the CIA once you're in the family.
Of course.
So Anderson Cooper was in the CIA.
The article was in. I can't tell you exactly where the article was right now, but if you Google Anderson Cooper CIA, you can easily find it. But it's confirmed. It's true. CNN confirmed it, and they said that he had interned with the CIA for a couple of summers during college.
Right, right.
And, but you don't just intern with the CIA. It's not
That's
like
right.
you're not. Yeah. It's not like working volunteering at your local animal shelter.
That's right. It's ongoing. They're all levels of involvement too. You've got obviously CIA agents, and then you have just people who would be journalists who just have a good relationship with them and cooperate with them. And they may not receive any money, but they maybe receive special considerations when it comes to promotion or whatever.
Right.
Woodward, he was in the intelligence community.
I don't know.
Woodward and Bernstein.
Okay.
When he was in the service, he was a briefer on intelligence for the National Security Council. So he obviously had his intelligence contacts continued, which I think puts a new light on Watergate. What was really going on in Watergate? If he was pipelined to the security agencies.
Right, right.
I wanted to try to get into a couple more of these articles that I have here to back up these messages very briefly. Here's one from by Tom Carver. It's from the BBC. It's from 2002. Just talks about the Pentagon is toying with the idea of black propaganda. As part of George Bush's war on terrorism, the military is thinking of planting propaganda and misleading stories in international media. And again, they use words like thinking about or toying with or going to try out. You know,
yes.
they never admit that they do anything, but yet every week we see articles that talk about more and more of it.
Yes.
And I've seen more recent stuff about hiring bloggers to blog pro-government issues. And this is very recent. This is under Obama. So this is in the past year. They hire people just to go out and troll message boards, that are right wing or left wing and have really well thought out responses to articles, because whenever you talk about articles or tweets or blogs or whatever, CNN or MSNBC will quote a blog or a tweet, that they get, which means nothing. What is a tweet from Joe Schmo out in Kansas?
Do you think that the tweets that get quoted then are carefully culled from the
I think they carefully select them. They get tens of thousands of them. How are they able to just go and randomly pull one out that sounds really smart, And then much more recently, 2006, this is from BBC as well. And BBC is not kind when reporting on American propaganda, even though they are one of the developers of propaganda. And this one is, Pentagon boosts media war unit. The U.S. Defense Department has set up a new unit to better promote its message across 24-hour rolling news outlets, and particularly on the Internet. The Pentagon said the move would boost its ability to counter inaccurate news stories and exploit new media. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said earlier this year the U.S. was losing the propaganda war to its enemies. On Monday, and its enemies, what they mean there, they intend for you to think their enemies are brown people in the Middle East. But well, they really mean us, though. We're the enemies.
Well, we've become the, you know, when what did Professor Miller say?
Enemies were saps.
Well, at the end, what did Professor Miller say at the end, that the government must fear its people? I believe Jefferson said, Thomas Jefferson said something very similar. If the government should fear the people, not the other way around.
Well, they don't have anything to fear if people aren't smart enough to know that they're being lied to. I mean,
well,
you know,
we've been lied to so many times, and it's been in their faces, and it just keeps happening again and again and again. And I feel like living in a very, I'm very apprehensive about anything that happens, because it just, you know, you don't know what's the truth.
It's, you know, that you have to discover it for yourself. You have to go out and find it. And, you know, as Gus said, if you look at the information is coming from, what's their agenda? And often you're not getting the truth from the mass media. As Professor Miller said, it really needs to be broken up. We need to go back to the days like when our democracies were more vital.
Well, that's what the Internet was supposed to be. Individuals speaking out. A free press.
Well, a lot of the information that Gus and I find in our research is from the Internet. Is it to some extent serving the purpose of breaking this media monopoly?
This stuff is so easily gotten. You know, a half an hour of just using a search engine, you can find another side to the story. But the government official news outlets spend all of their time trying to demonize people who have a different opinion.
When you say government, you're referring to the
CNN,
networks?
I mean CNN, Fox, MSNBC,
which
CBS.
Essentially are acting as extensions of our government.
I think we're so oversaturated with propaganda that it has implications that weren't even conceived by Bernier.
Right.
We are lied to everywhere by products that are placed in front of us, by political things that are put in front of us, by wars that are put in front of us. Everywhere we turn,
everything
is propagandized. I don't think anybody could foresee how that has an impact on a society.
And what you're saying,
we're in uncharted territory.
What you're saying dovetails with just the last point I wanted to try to make before we run out of time.
Yes,
this is another article I found, and it's referencing last year when the Entertainment Industry Foundation, the EIF. Brought together all the major networks, ABC, CBS, Fox, NBC, and had them interweave, as they put it, organically weave, quote-unquote, government propaganda stories into their shows. And I think it's referred to as propaganda placement or situation placement. And the clip that we're going to play is not from this week, of shows, because those were primarily about volunteerism, but they also subliminally touched on healthcare, the bailouts, the environment, global warming, and by global warming I mean cap and trade, which is just that doesn't benefit anybody or the environment.
So this clip relates
but
to
this,
a different
this
issue.
Clip will is from one of the shows that participated, and it's a year later, and basically it shows that they continually get their talking points from the government. So it didn't stop with this one week. And people said, oh, it's just a week. But it shows you that it continually goes on. And one of the recent major stories in the news is the right-wing extremists, okay? And any person who believes in conspiracy theories. So why don't we play the clip?
Well, people that believe in conspiracy theories, please raise their hands in the studio.
Please note that all hands went up.
I think I may know a little something about your poison victim.
And I'm here to prove a man innocent. I got a little intel on Professor Scott. He has a history of espousing various conspiracy theories, sharing them with his students got him into a little trouble. Every university has at least one unconventional professor.
Oh, come on, Peyton. This guy's ideas here are totally anti-American. Look at this.
water fluoridation, tsunami bombs, chemtrails.
What are chemtrails?
Now, some people believe that vapor exhaust from aircraft are actually dangerous biochemicals dispersed into the air.
Which only proves that Kevin's a little odd.
Okay, you're back on.
All right, so he's just a little bit odd. But he's anti-American, you know, he's a kook. And it goes on in the show to show that he is a bomber and he poisons people. And so he's the bad guy. He's un-American, he's an extremist right-winger, and he believes in chemtrails and water fluoridation. And it's well-documented, well-proven. Fluoride is bad for you. It's in a lot of the city's waters. It's an industrial waste. The Nazis used it. The communist Russians used it as a way to damage people's minds and keep them from ever wising up. And they want them to be docile. It's not for your teeth. That's not what it's for.
And these are basic propaganda techniques. You associate someone you don't like with a phrase or an image that we all agree is unpleasant. So right. Anti-Americanism.
All right.
And it works.
Yeah.
Ken, we're out of time for this evening.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. And thank you, listeners,
thank you
for supporting WPKN 89.5 FM, because we're able to present you information because of your generosity that's not available elsewhere. So thank you very much.
And that's coming from Ken McDermott Rowe, WPKN's Doctor of Democracy.
Thank you very much. And I'm joined tonight by
Gus Cantavero.
Thank you.
Ken, the next program is going to be very interesting. Another program about the CIA and
The assassination of John F. Kennedy. And that program is going to be on Sunday, August the 1st at 10 p.m.
It's a light topic.
And Wednesday, August the 4th at 6:30 p.m. We're on in a new time on Wednesday. That's 6:30 p.m. We used to be at 12:30, so 6:30 p.m. JFK and the involvement of the evidence indicating the involvement of the CIA in his assassination. And then in September, we're looking to focus on 9/11, which, you know, may be another example of the big lie. We don't know. But a lot of people in the 9/11 Truth Movement think
all right,
so.
All right, Ken, for more information about your show and your research,
Go to historycounts.org, and we have all our shows archived for free listening.
Right, and what about Gus's video manipulations of the programs that you've done?
You'll find an index to the videos that Gus has created at historycounts.org, a direct link to them. And they're very, especially we got a comment this week on the 9/11 video.
I was proud to receive that comment. He said, now I know what happened. It was like, wow.
Exactly. The fella said it was based on Stephen Jones. The video is put together based on Stephen Jones' presentation.
It adds an important element to what you're doing. I think that's great.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes.